The stage is set. Get a front row seat in the run-up to the election by subscribing to The Spectator for just £3 for 3 months. We'll even send you a free election mug. Go to spectator.co.uk/mug.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, following Joe Biden's debate disaster, Freddie Gray asks, will Jill let her husband stand down? Angus Colwell reads his letter from Israel, where it seems like they're readying for another war. Taking issue with the slogan 14 years of Tory misrule, Matthew Paris reappraises the recent history of Conservative leadership. Flora Watkins provides her notes on the modern mother's ruin, G&T's in a can. And finally, Rory Sutherland argues that we already know where to look for the next Bond villain, Elon Musk. Up first, Freddie Gray.
At rallies, Joe Biden often speaks after his wife. My name is Joe Biden and I'm Jill's husband, he begins. It's a line he has used for years, a faux humble joke about how much more impressive she is. These days, however, it sounds more like an admission of the real pecking order. In the past week, we've seen the extent to which Dr. Jill Biden, as she insists on being called, has taken charge of her ailing spouse's collapsing campaign. This week, she appeared on the cover of American Vogue, looking imperious in a white tuxedo dress. "We will decide our future," shouts the quote headline. That's a very royal we, isn't it? After that painful presidential debate last Thursday, as Donald Trump strolled off stage left, Jill took the humiliated Joe by the hand and led him gingerly down the steps. The pair then went to an event with fans at an Atlanta hotel. "Joe, you did such a great job," shouted Jill as the commander-in-chief stood by her grinning feebly. "You answered every question." She was slightly more candid with Vogue. "We will not let those 90 minutes define the 4 years he's been president," she said, when asked about the debate. "We will continue to fight." Sources close to the Bidens have long said that Jill is the one person who can persuade Joe to stand down. "The only person who has ultimate influence with him is the First Lady," says an insider. For now, however, even as a growing number of Biden's supporters say he ought to do the honourable thing and resign ahead of the Democratic National Convention in August, Jill seems ever more determined to cling on. The First Lady is not for turning. Jill tends to brush over the evident reality that Joe's body and brain are breaking down with saccharine statements about the nobility of his soul. "I want you to hear Joe's words," she tells audiences. "But most of all, I want you to listen to his heart." If it all sounds a bit desperate, that's because it is. The Biden inner circle has taken to attacking fellow Democrats who are not keeping the faith and doubling down on their insistence that Biden is the only man who can beat Trump. "The bedwetting brigade is calling for Biden to drop out," said Deputy Campaign Manager Rob Flaherty at the end of last week. "That is the best possible way for Donald Trump to win and us to lose. Joe Biden is going to be the Democratic nominee, period. End of story." It's widely rumoured that Jill is the driving force behind this defiance. The Daily Caller, a mischievous right-wing website, now calls her Lady McBiden. Jill wasn't always interested in the relentless pursuit of power, at least not according to her husband's memoirs. In 1975, Joe, a grieving widower and freshman senator, was introduced to Jill by his brother Frank. "You're like her, Joe," said Frank. "She's not interested in politics." Joe and Jill went on a date, and their romance began. "She gave me back my life," wrote Joe. "She made me feel normal again." He proposed her repeatedly, but Jill, a divorcee 8 years his junior, demurred. She was a part-time model who wanted to pursue her own career in education. Joe eventually offered not to stand for re-election to the Senate if she agreed to marry him. To prove he meant it, he dialed the number of a reporter in order to announce that he would not be standing again. Jill cut off the call with her thumb, saying, "If I denied you your dream, I would not be marrying the man I fell in love with." That's the story, anyway. A cynic might say she already had her eyes firmly on the prize. Now in the White House, She's often criticised for putting herself at the forefront of her man's administration. In 2021, she posted a picture of herself on social media, pen in hand, looking studious and important. "Prepping for the G7," she wrote. At that summit, she appeared to form a bond with Carrie Johnson, another political wife often accused of meddling in key decisions. According to Joe, his two sons, Beau and Hunter, who had lost their mother in a car crash, soon took to his second wife and called her Mom. "I considered her to be my mother as much as one can possibly imagine," confirmed Hunter in his own memoir, Beautiful Things. Yet these heartwarming accounts of Biden familial togetherness were somewhat tarred last month when Hunter's criminal trial revealed text messages in which he had called his stepmother entitled and a vindictive moron. Jill did pursue her career as an educator and has used her husband's position to advance the causes she cares about. In 2021, as First Lady of an America still reeling from the COVID pandemic, she successfully pushed for emergency funding to be granted to students who had been worst affected by school closures. But Dr. Jill's own academic qualifications have been the subject of some doubt. Whoopi Goldberg may have once called for her to be America's next Surgeon General, but the First Lady is not a real doctor. She doesn't even have a PhD, but an EDD, a doctorate in education, a famously easy degree which school administrators use to increase their salaries. Her dissertation, or executive position paper, was littered with typos and non sequiturs. On the first of more than 100 pages, she described a class in Delaware's Technical Community College. 3/4 of the class will be Caucasian, 1/4 of the class will be African American, 1 seat will hold a Latino, and the remaining seats will be filled with students of Asian descent or non-resident aliens. Numbers are not her forte, clearly. She also proposed that a future school administration may want to consider an 8-week study week. After various conservative commentators teased her about these errors, her many allies on America's pro-democratic news channels rushed out to call their mockery misogynistic. It's true that compared with her husband, Jill is a model of clarity and coherence. She does, however, commit the occasional faux pas. Speaking to a Hispanic conference in 2022, she praised the diversity of this community, as distinct as the bodegas of the Bronx, as beautiful as the blossoms of Miami, and as unique as the breakfast tacos here in San Antonio. The National Association of Hispanic Journalists issued a wounded response, urging the First Lady to better understand the complexities of our people. "We are not tacos." That must have hurt Jill, who prides herself on her normally impeccable political correctness. Her speeches are full of nods to the progressive orthodoxies of the 21st century Democratic Party. At recent campaign events, she has struck a decidedly feminist note as she talks about the need to protect women from Republican attempts to restrict abortion. "When our bodies are on the line," she says, "when our daughters' futures are at stake, when our country and its freedom hang in the balance, it's time we show them, once again, just what we can do." It's funny then that today she seems to be standing in the way of America's first woman president. After last week, a number of voices in the Democratic Party have begun calling for Biden to make way for Kamala Harris, his vice president. Harris may be less popular than Biden, runs the argument, but at least she doesn't appear to be dying on the campaign trail. For now, however, Dr. Jill is refusing to listen. In her professional opinion, Joe is where he needs to be.
That was Freddie Gray. Next, Angus Colwell.
According to my phone, I'm in Beirut International Airport. Except I'm not. The Israel Defense Forces have scrambled the GPS of everyone within about an hour's drive of the Israel-Lebanon border. The same navigation system that tells my iPhone its location is the same navigation system that Hezbollah could use to identify targets in northern Israel. Hezbollah have been firing across the border since the 7th of October, and the Israelis are fed up. They've evacuated 80 kibbutzes, 9 villages, 3 community centres, and 2 Arab villages. The phrase that ministers use to describe the displaced is refugees in their own country. The offensive in Gaza is winding down, and after that, says an official, we are ready to deal with Lebanon. This week, the British Embassy advised people to leave Lebanon if they can. Israeli officials sound resigned, prepared, perhaps raring for war on the northern front. We are talking weeks, maybe days, one says. I don't know how literally to take them. As you get further north, it gets quieter and quieter, and the cars all start coming the other way. The evacuated areas, among vineyards and fields where bananas and avocados grow, have become known as ghost towns. Out in the field in 32-degree heat, I can only hear one thing. Crickets. Hezbollah has launched more than 10,000 rockets in the past 9 months, and the Iron Dome has had little trouble intercepting them. The anti-tank missiles are trickier to stop. Sirens can and do go off at any time. I'm with a group of journalists with the Europe-Israel Press Association. We're told to get off the bus, lie down, and cover our heads if the sirens go off. On the way to Mitzuva, a kibbutz right on the border, the IDF suggests we change destination and go elsewhere. It doesn't matter that I'm not a soldier. When Hezbollah see people, they fire at them, they say. Hezbollah is a more sophisticated enemy than Hamas. It has close links with Iran, a giant arsenal of rockets, about 25,000 fighters and 30,000 reservists. But Israeli officials insist that they aren't scared. I sleep like a baby, says a bespectacled IDF lieutenant colonel, who spends his days staring at the Lebanese mountains from a few miles away. If Israel has to turn north, he says, what's happened in Gaza will be child's play. In the quiet northern town of Mate Asher, a 15-minute drive from the border, Ishai Afroni never takes his hand off his massive gun. He's the head of security for the regional council. He looks scary, but he's sweet, says the mayor, chuckling. Afroni doesn't chuckle or smile. The situation is intolerable, he says, especially for children. They had COVID for 2 years and another year out of school because of Hezbollah. If they don't go back on the 1st of September, they'll miss another year, he says. In 2 weeks' time, Mate Asher will host a raft-building competition for some of the children who've remained. They have to feel that life is in some way normal, he says. Israel is prepared to strike deep into Lebanese territory if Hezbollah don't stop the attacks. One official says, if a rocket hits Haifa, then something is going to happen to Beirut. I won't say they'll go back to the Stone Age, but there will be a big problem with electricity. The threat goes the other way too. Israeli research recently concluded that the Iron Dome could be overwhelmed by Hezbollah's arsenal. A government electricity official said Israel would become unlivable if the power goes out. But the fear of Hezbollah's arsenal doesn't seem to frighten Israeli officials. Zohar Palti, a former head of the Mossad Intelligence Directorate, admits that Hezbollah could even strike some tall buildings in Tel Aviv. But do you expect us to be paralysed? He says. We visit the kibbutz near Oz the next day. A quarter of its residents were killed or kidnapped on the 7th of October. A woman named Irit Lahav meets us. She spent more than 7 hours hiding in her safe room that day, saying goodbye to her daughter. Her makeshift lock worked, and she somehow still lives here. We step over shattered glass and enter houses blackened by heat bombs. They stink. We're a 2-minute drive from Gaza, and you can hear, every minute or so, the terrifying throbbing sound of Israeli cannon fire. The amount of agony crammed in these square miles is vast. Theresa May once said there are girl jobs and boy jobs. There's no such thing in Israel. Many of the IDF soldiers I meet are young women with Americanish accents. One I speak to is fascinated I'm from London. She's been there a few times. I try to convince her that her life is slightly more interesting than mine at the moment. She has family in the UK but grew up in Israel and was drafted to the IDF last year. She's just 18. She'll serve for a bit, but after the war is done, she wants to open a restaurant. I really, really hate war, she says. But sometimes the only way to get peace is through force. On Tel Aviv beach, football-mad crowds gather to watch Italy versus Croatia on a big projector screen. I fall asleep to the sound of people playing beach volleyball, and I wake up to the sound of people playing beach volleyball. Most Israelis I talk to sleep well. No one seems ready for the war that everyone expects, but they insist that they are.
That was Angus Colwell. Now, Matthew Paris.
Memorably sweeping statements, tripping easily from the tongue, have a habit of worming their way into assumptions we make and ending up as the judgment of history. The word appeasement, rather than the decisions Neville Chamberlain actually took, have consigned the name of a defensible statesman to something approaching a term of abuse. Milk snatcher did Margaret Thatcher immense damage. The winter of discontent has become too easy a shorthand for the coinciding of deep-seated problems which Thatcher herself approached with great caution. Dementia tax was an expression critically important in the ultimate downfall of a prime minister. Theresa May, who'd proposed a rational means of underwriting care for the elderly, not in fact that any new tax should be levied upon them or anyone else, but that when assessing eligibility for a taxpayer's contribution to their care costs, the value of their house should no longer be excluded from the estimate of their means. Arrangements were available for them to keep the house until they died by drawing current income against its future value. The real losers, those who stood to inherit, were never going to like the idea, but the term dementia tax misled millions more into regarding the proposition with horror. This general election is set, I'm afraid, to add another sweeping statement, as fluent as it is glib, to the list of killer phrases rooting itself in the national imagination. We have most assuredly not had 14 years of Tory misrule. But you'll hardly find any media commentary on this election that does not contain the words 14 years, followed by one or another generalised castigation of Conservative government. The truth is different. We've had 14 years, not unlike any other longish period of government, plenty of quiet competence and plenty of inglorious incompetence too, a scatter of signal successes and a handful of ghastly blunders, and, as ever, a sprinkling of newsworthy scandals, some of little consequence, others engendering public shock. Here's my view of our five prime ministers since the fall of Gordon Brown. David Cameron's time at Downing Street from 2010 to 2016 ended in failure only if you think calling a referendum on Britain's EU membership was wrong. The real mistake, I believe, was made by the electorate after he'd done so. He should never have asked us, but he did, and that's democracy. His other big gamble, the Scottish referendum, paid off. The SNP was never the same again. Otherwise, Cameron's tenure was notably smoothly handled and comprises almost half the 14 years of Tory-led government. I still miss the five coalition years. Without austerity, the economy could have buckled, and many of the cuts he and George Osborne made were to wasteful spending. The cuts to local government were too harsh, and the Libyan adventure was a miscalculation, but one his Labour predecessors would almost certainly have made. Cameron's determination to legislate for gay marriage was brave, and throughout he looked and sounded like a proper Prime Minister. There was nothing mean, hateful or bitter about his leadership. I would happily see him back in Downing Street. Theresa May was not cut out for the job, but behaved with dignity and brought intelligence and integrity to an impossible task. She had a sort of nobility. It all ended in the political equivalent of an appalling traffic snarl-up, but Brexit had made the Commons unmanageable by any PM with only a tiny majority. Imagine Sir Keir Starmer trying to negotiate with both the EU and his own party. Would he have done any better? A transitional figure, she held the fort. Boris Johnson's tenure is the most seriously prolonged disaster zone among the prime ministerships on this list. About his own moral qualities, enough has been said. But kicking out a whole cadre of some of the best men and women in the party was sheer vandalism. For me, this was the last straw. I quit my membership. In his apparently blithe and carefree way, Johnson demeaned himself, cheapened our politics, and injected a poison into the Tory bloodstream, toxicity that endures. He will, mark my words, attempt a comeback. Beware. Of Liz Truss, the less said the better. She left her successor a shocking mess. I believe Rishi Sunak did a sterling job getting grown-up government back on its feet after Johnson and Truss. As Chancellor during COVID and then in Downing Street through a period of European war and global inflation, he steadied things. It was he, not Johnson, who finally got Brexit done by fixing a problem, Northern Ireland's interposition between Great Britain and the European Union, that had defeated May and that Johnson had failed to solve by his dishonest bluster. Sunak showed a shaky hand in some of the small things that should be second nature to a prime minister. Insulting the Greek prime minister was rude and silly. A bigger judgment call, his amputation of the part of HS2 that made the project viable, was baffling. The D-Day blunder was hard to forgive, and calling an early general election looks no less nutty a decision now than it did at the time. But the fact remains that over the past 18 months, an atmosphere of looming chaos that had gathered around British government has lifted. Shrieks have been replaced by grumbles, and a fundamentally decent, stable, even admirable person has been in charge. When the dust has settled, and when Keir Starmer has demonstrated that there are not, after all, any obvious answers, Sunak will be judged more kindly. And those Tory years as a whole? A mixed performance, occasionally awful, often impressive, from which Britain emerges in one piece and, looking over one shoulder at politics on the European continent and over the other at America, in reasonable shape. It's time for a change. So let's see if Labour can make it look any easier.
That was Matthew Paris. Now Flora Watkins.
I'm writing this in my car, laptop on knees, at a delicious can of Tanqueray Flor de Sevilla gin and tonic in the drinks holder, while my sons are at cricket practice. It's an inclement evening, but were it a sunny summer's day, the yummy mummies would be sprawled around the boundary in their Veya trainers and prairie dresses, pastel-coloured tins in hand, cackling and catching up like some Gen X version of Hogarth's Gin Lane. Gins in tins are the acceptable form of mother's ruin. First came Gordon's G&T in a tin, followed by its pink gin, and now the chiller aisle contains more temptation than the Haribo shelves do for my children. Bombay Sapphire, Tanqueray, Sipsmith, and multiple artisan brands have got in on the act. They're usually on offer at your preferred supermarket, with three for the price of four. That is, unless you plump for supermarket brand gin tins, which come in at about 99p each. Gins in tins are part of the fastest growing drinks market, that of RTDs, ready to drink cocktails. Post-pandemic, volume sales have outperformed white spirits, with the market estimated to have reached 884 million last year, according to Alice Baker, a senior research analyst at Mintel. And usage of RTDs is highest among the under 45s, she confirms. Perma-stressed working mothers like me now think little of cracking open a Sipsmith's canned G&T or Grey Goose vodka spritzer instead of putting the kettle on when they get in from the school run. One friend says, "Gins in tins at four on a Friday was basically why I signed my son up for cricket. It's rude not to there." My grandparents' generation had the gin tray, brought out at 6 p.m. with cut glass tumblers, vicious measures of Gordon's, half a bottle of Flat Schweppes tonic water and some little dishes of salted crisps and Opie's cocktail onions. Some older people, like my great friend Roger, an antiques dealer, continue this tradition. But after one of his tinctures, I need to lie down. And that isn't the point of gins in tins. I don't want to get wasted. I've got some half-assed parenting to do and possibly need to drive. What gins in tins provide is more akin to a socially acceptable form of Xanax, or the Valium doled out to 1950s housewives. They just take the edge off endlessly bickering siblings and battles over homework. The late Shirley Conran said that life was too short to stuff a mushroom. In the post-Brexit, post-pandemic era, when the fantastic au pairs we once employed are a distant dream, frankly, who has time to locate ice, the gin bottle, and a can of Fever Tree, only to find you run out of lemons? A tin of chilled Bombay Collins, my current favourite, it tastes just like a piquant lemon barley water, consumed at a family flashpoint, is one of the best life hacks I know. RTDs are targeted at women. Portobello Road gin and tonic looks seriously swanky. You'll be the envy of the train with this in your hand, reads a recent blind testing on the BBC Good Food website. One of the few male aficionados I know is my godfather, though he is fond of declaiming, a can of Gordon's gin and tonic is the perfect mixer for a large measure of Gordon's.
That was Flora Watkins. And finally, Rory Sutherland.
People sometimes ask me why I don't go into politics. Why on earth would I do that? No, if you want to exercise power and imagination, the only remaining role which appeals is to be some kind of Bond villain. To anyone familiar with modern bureaucracy, there's something hugely attractive about an organisation where the HR department is replaced by a pool full of sharks. I think this fantasy largely explains why electorates are now drawn to candidates who seem a tiny bit sinister or weird. Who knows, they think, they might actually do something different. Never mind Trump, my guess is that if Elon Musk were eligible to run for president, he'd get 60% of the vote. As he's an avowed Bond fan and born in South Africa before TV broadcasting was allowed, when wealthy families projected their own feature films at home, I suspect the influence of Bond villains on the young Elon may explain more than just his love of rocketry. Let's consider the film Goldfinger. Now, from what I remember of the story, Ulrich Goldfinger, the villain, had a plan not to steal the gold from Fort Knox, but instead to explode a Chinese-supplied nuclear dirty bomb within the facility, thereby rendering the gold worthless and hugely increasing the value of his own holdings. I'm not entirely sure that Goldfinger's plan would have been economically feasible, to be honest. And besides, anyone owning a Lockheed Jetstar with Honor Blackman as his personal pilot would probably have given up on any further life goals. Nevertheless, the plot might help us understand the overall grand strategy behind Musk's business dealings through the lens of Bondology. To date, Musk has created battery-powered vehicles, extensive charging networks, a vast network of satellites providing internet access to the surface of the planet, solar panels, batteries for electrical storage, and a $50,000 tiny house, which can be erected in about an hour. He also owns Twitter, which gives him huge marketing power. You must be able to see a pattern emerging here. What if his dastardly plan is to tank the world's housing markets, and with it the banking sector? After all, what he is doing is creating a combination of technologies that make it possible for people to live anywhere, not just on the grid. Here's the thing most people don't know. Your house isn't actually worth that much. What makes it expensive is the land on which it sits and the planning permission to build on it. Bricks are not scarce, land is not scarce, but buildable land is. Yet what people need is not an investment in land, it's a stable place to live. At present, you are forced to buy the first to acquire the second. It's as though you had to buy $5,000 worth of Samsung shares every time you bought a $1,000 television. But what if you could separate home from land ownership? This is what a US trailer park does, or a houseboat. Trailer homes aren't cool, true, but you could easily make trailer homes as cool as they are affordable. After all, Peckham wasn't cool in 2005. All Elon needs to do is create a solar-charged Tesla motorhome or a trailer with a 200-kilowatt battery, Starlink internet access, and an incinerator toilet, and this separation of house and land ownership becomes feasible. Woodlands, pub car parks, farms all become potential residential land. You can deliver a home in a day rather than months. You can manufacture them in the way we make cars, as Buckminster Fuller always intended. And you can finally move house without having to move out of your house. Not many people will do this at first, but for enough people, the appeal will be there. It's potentially easy to build a million houses. What Elon might have created is a lot more places to put them.
Before you go, there are still a few tickets left for our very special live recording of Coffee House Shots, taking place this coming Thursday, the 11th of July. Join Fraser Nelson, Katie Bulls, and Kate Andrews, plus a very special guest, at 7 p.m. here in Westminster, as they make sense of the aftermath of the election. Tickets are £35 or £25 for subscribers, and you can book online at spectator.co.uk/shotslive. And that's everything for this week. If you've enjoyed those articles, why not pick up a copy of the Spectator magazine to read them and many more in full. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.